Henry, hit the theme song.
No, it's terrible. It's out of tune.
Do it again.
No, it's, well, it's out of tune. What am I going to tune it?
All right, podcast? Welcome back to This Is Rocket Science, the official Columbia Space Initiative podcast. I'm one of your hosts, David Tibbetts.
And my name is Henry.
We have a lot of new people in live studio audience today. We actually have quite a few prospective students of the Foo Foundation School of Engineering and Applied Science at Columbia University. Welcome, welcome. If you decide to go somewhere else, shame on you.
If you decide to go to Cornell, oh my god.
If you decide to go to Cornell, oh my god.
So what are we talking about today? We're talking about the black hole image.
Black hole image, because, yeah. Oh my god. Did we finish the Apollo from last time?
No, but honestly, we got more important to get to right now. Like,
Apollo, done, did. Black holes,
yeah, we got to like Apollo 15. Like, there's nothing interesting after that anyway. So
the point is, we have things to talk about. For those of you who are joining us for the first time in the live studio audience, feel free to interject whenever you want to.
Yeah, the more you guys like ask questions, the less actual
and
like talking
ask,
and
like
thinking I'll have to do.
Too. Like Micah is famously known for just asking absolutely
perfect.
Just literally ask dumb things. But Micah does it all the time.
Why was the black hole image so blurry?
Ooh, okay. So let me just give like
the camera's moving.
Yeah, we could just give like the background on the black hole image too. This thing has been, they've been trying to take a picture of a black hole for decades, and sort of. Well, first I'll just, should we explain what a black hole is? We've done this like 20 times
on
the
podcast, but it's definitely necessary.
I mean, it's hard to summarize, like, it's extremely complicated.
Black holes are very dense and very heavy, and light cannot escape them at a certain point called the event horizon. There's a black space in space.
Yes. A star dies, and it leaves behind this very dense core. The escape velocity at the event horizon is the speed of light. Light can't escape. Nothing can escape, because nothing can travel faster than light. So I guess the first sort of question that you could think of is, what does it even mean to take an image of a black hole, right? Because it's black, you know, light can't escape it. So what are we even doing here? Black holes, it's a very interesting dichotomy, because black holes, you can't think of anything, I guess, more absorbent and therefore darker, right? Because nothing can escape, light can't escape. But at the same time, it's surrounded by this accretion disk. Basically all this matter coming from stars, planets, anything being sucked into it. And that stuff is moving close to the speed of light. It's moving, you know, millions of miles per hour. So it's insanely hot. It's the hottest thing in the universe, quasars, which is like a form of a black hole. So the reason why there's any point in taking this image at all is because we can see the accretion disk. So you see that picture. I wish there was any way that we could like
Google
show a
right
picture.
Now.
Yes. Sit down
everyone's
and Google the picture.
There's a million memes. Everyone's seen it.
You've seen Lord of the Rings. You know what it looks like.
It looks like a big orange donut
exactly.
On a black background.
But to answer your question about why it's so blurry, it's incredibly far away. The diameter of our galaxy is about 100,000 light years. And Sagittarius A star, which is one of the two black holes we imaged, is at the center of our galaxy. So I think we're near the edge of our galaxy. So that would mean that somewhere in the range of 50,000 light years.
Which I remember correlated to some interesting geology things. 55 million years ago was when the first grass started to develop. So at the time, if I'm right about the dating, which I'm pretty sure I am. I gotta verify this now, actually.
I know, I'm trying to Google, trying to find it.
But yeah, it's incredibly far away. It's very fascinating, the technique they actually used to get this picture. So it's not like they just pointed a telescope at the black hole and just took like a 2-second exposure and were like, all right. What they actually did is something called long-range interferometry. Basically, they had multiple telescopes around the world. In particular, they had the big one was in the Atacama in Chile. But they also have the VLA, the Very Large Array in New Mexico. They also have one in Antarctica, actually. And they had to, the files were so big that they had to literally like store them on hard drives and fly them in from different locations. So part of the reason why it took so long is because they got a bunch of observations from Antarctica and they literally had to put them on a plane and then take them to Harvard.
M87, 55 million light years away.
Okay,
so
that makes
55
sense.
Million light years away, it's the photographed one. The light that's coming from that is from a time on Earth's history where grass didn't even exist yet.
So
that's wacky to think about, honestly.
You said it was the center of the universe.
The center of our galaxy.
Of our galaxy.
Yeah. Yeah. Distinction.
Those two are different things. So my question is, since Fallen Apart, after you made that clarification, but does our galaxy does have a definite center, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why is the black hole that center? Is it because it's so massive that it kind of weighs down and everything floats gravitationally around it?
Sort of. I mean, it's thought that almost every single large galaxy that we've ever observed had a supermassive black hole at the center. So it might be the other way around, in the sense that if there was no supermassive black hole, we wouldn't even have a galaxy. Hmm. Yeah. But basically, a supermassive black hole like Sagittarius A star, I mean, we've already talked about in previous episodes the distinction about the different types of black holes, but generally they're somewhere in the range of like 1 billion to 100 billion times the mass of our sun. But some of them are, you know, like hundreds of millions. Yeah, they're very large, and they sort of act as they're the center of mass of our galaxy, so everything's orbiting around it. So that's why we say it's the center.
Okay, so some more info on this particular black hole. It's also way bigger than the supermassive black hole center of our galaxy. The reason they took a picture of this one, not just because it was also just kind of random, like, oh, let's point there, oh, let's just take a picture of that one. But it's also, it's super far away, but it's also really, really big. It's 6.5 billion times the mass of our sun.
Were there any surprises when they took the image? Like, or was it pretty much what everyone had already modeled and expected?
It was pretty much what everyone expected.
That's a scientific victory in a sense.
Yeah,
I think so. It wasn't like purple or something. You know, like it was orange.
Yeah. Well, also.
You know, that would have been.
Well, also, it's false color. That image is a radio image.
Yeah.
It's not even invisible light. They could have scaled that to whatever color they actually wanted to. But.
So who gets to do the art? Who gets to, like, decide what color it is?
I don't know. That's a good question.
And why, you know, why,
I mean, there's
why
that
not,
team.
Like, neon green or more, like, the forest green, you know, more soothing color.
Or Pantone
292.
Columbia Blue.
If Mike Massimino had done the imaging, it would have been Pantone 292.
Sadly, this discovery came out of Harvard. This team at Harvard has been working on this for, I think, like 8 years or something. Like, multiple teams have been doing it for decades. But they did it, they were working on it in 2016, because I remember I took a summer astrophysics class at Harvard, and I got to meet the whole team because they were there and they gave a presentation, which was really cool.
What were different parts of the picture of the black hole? It seems like they were sensitive, like the different orange and then the obvious actual black hole.
The orange thing itself, that's the accretion disk we were talking about.
It's not even though, right?
Well, it should be somewhat even. I think the reason why it wasn't exactly even is because we're not looking at it like this way or level, like it's at some angle to us.
Okay.
But yeah, it should be fairly even if you were to look at like top down at the accretion disk. But then there's like the event horizon itself, that part that's just black and there's nothing there. That's pretty much all that we can see in that image.
So
I don't know, like
black hole itself.
Yeah, very, very rapidly. Most black holes.
How can you tell that? And like,
oh, you can't tell
that
from
the
image.
Like, surrounding objects if it's spinning, it's already like.
Basically, nothing outside of the magnetic effects. In fact, like, I don't know, like the center of mass isn't changing at all. Like, it's so large that it's spinning along the axis of its center of mass. So, like, in terms of gravitation, none of the objects around it really notice that spinning.
Oh.
But it has this magnetic field that's like going crazy all the time.
So that's the only way you can detect it.
Yeah. Oh. We've talked about this before, but there's many types of black holes. One of them is a quasar, and basically that looks like a normal black hole with an accretion disk, but there's two like crazy looking jets coming out of the top of it.
Yeah.
But that's just because the magnetic field, it's spinning so quickly that it's like ejecting all this matter.
And does it spin at an even rate, or does it slow up or speed down, or
I don't know. I mean, presumably it's fairly even.
We got him.
I've been exposed. But I feel like it has to be fairly consistent, just because think about like its moment of inertia. Like this is a black hole. This has like billions of solar masses. Like, I doubt it would be easy to spin it up.
There are the spinning, is it stars, the pulsars?
Yeah.
Does any similar phenomenon with the pulsing exist with black holes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, those are like gamma ray bursts, like they call
okay.
them GRBs. But yeah, pulsars are neutron stars, but like very similar. They sort of mirror each other.
So, David, you were going to say something about the geological implications of...
About that grass.
Oh, it's just related to, like, the history of the Earth. Like, a lot of things that we have today just didn't exist back then.
Is there a reason that all these events coincided?
No, like...
There's no, like, universal...
No, it's not like we took this picture and then grass formed, like...
It's cause and effect.
See, bro, I don't know nothing.
It's cause and effect.
That's true.
Do you if we had 5 million years, like, it'd just be a different story.
So, if I remember from, like, my middle school science class, like, once these super large suns, like, produce, like, lead... Like,
you learned about this in middle?
Right? They collapse, and those are the largest ones, collapse into black holes once they start producing lead. It's like the chain reaction thing, right?
I wish I learned.
There's denser things than lead in the universe, right? So,
how
did Earth end up with it, and, like, where did it come from?
That is such a good question. Oh my god, that makes me so happy.
I'm a music major.
Well, so in terms of, I think what you're talking about is how, like, so right now the sun is like 99.99% hydrogen, and it's very slowly but surely fusing all that hydrogen into helium.
Especially like the outside stuff, right?
Yep, exactly. So at some point, almost all the hydrogen
away. Helium.
Just can you shut up for 1 second?
Does the sun talk really high pitched?
Oh my god. So then at some point all of that hydrogen is gonna be exhausted. And
Bless you.
That was loud. And then you'll just have helium. And that helium is gonna start fusing into beryllium? What even is that? I don't know.
Beryllium is 4.
Beryllium's 4, there we go. Lithium, is that a
lithium
thing?
It formed from decay.
Yeah, true. I don't know anything about the periodic table. But, yeah, like you were talking about, it stops at hydrogen in the sense that after hydrogen, fusion becomes inefficient. You get less energy from it than you do putting into it. Mm-hmm. So, like you were saying, like in the normal life cycle of a star, you can't form anything larger than iron. But where all those other elements come from
iron, is that like for a star like the size of the sun?
Much bigger than the sun, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right that even in the biggest stars, it stops at iron. The reason why we have stuff like uranium, like higher atoms with more protons and neutrons, the reason why that happened is because in very, very large stars, when they go supernova, when they collapse and form a black hole and expand, you know, rebound, and you see this crazy supernova, that usually occurs at a temperature way, way higher than the normal functions of a star, like trillions of degrees. And that'll form every other element in existence. And that also explains why they're so rare. Because they can...
The plutonium stuff, because that was like man-made. How do we do that without the sun?
Well, plutonium is man-made in a certain regard that it has a really short half-life. All the naturally occurring one has already decayed into... I think it decays back to thorium, then to cesium, then lead. Most of them decay back to lead, but it's man-made in the sense that we decay a bunch of uranium into it. It's a byproduct of fission. It's not like purely man-made. Like you does form in stars and stuff, but the ones we have are.
It has never been observable in its natural.
Oh, certainly it has. But like not in usable quantities.
I'm like now trying to visualize like the diagrams I've seen of the inside of the Earth. Like it's really weird. Like there's a crust, and you're a geologist, so there's a bunch of cool things. You like the stuff in the crust, right?
As a mineralogist, yeah.
Yeah. Like what about like why is the stuff uneven like the dense parts, and then like what's it actually is there? So there's a lot of things in the crust. Is that same like mixture deposits all the way through to the core, or is it more general? Like,
not in the slightest.
But.
Most of the time for a quick geology lesson. Okay.
Oh God.
So a lot of the big rocks in the Earth are categorized into two categories: felsic, which is mostly feldspar and silica, very light elements or minerals rather, and the other ones are the mafic rocks, which comes from magnesium and iron. It's actually kind of funny. You got Fe, feldspar, Si, silica, mafic, magnesium. Iron? Fe is iron, so it kind of makes sense. But varying densities of rock. Anyways, as the Earth was originally forming, there's a lot of heat around it. Obviously, heat just retaining from the origin of the solar system. from radioactive decay, from impacts of, you know, the super asteroid period. At the beginning of the Earth during the Hadean Eon, what is that, 4.2 billion years ago, everything was molten. And during that time, everything was dense, sunk right down to the bottom, everything was light, stayed at the top. It wasn't like a perfect mixture, but like that's the reason why our core is super dense in metals and why our crust is super, you know, light. We have silicas and carbons. As it cooled down, obviously the crust cooled off completely. That's mostly, again, your felsic rocks, that's your, you have granites, and that's just about it. That's the majority of it. The most common mineral in the Earth's crust is feldspar. It's your, you know, your pink stuff, your gray stuff in granite. Now you get down to the mantle, the most common mineral is olivine, which is an ultramafic rock. It's mostly magnesium. Way denser. You go farther down, and you get the straight metal.
Earthquakes and stuff, but how does different things move within the core? Like
within the core, okay, so the center...
Sorry, the mantle core, all of it.
The inner core is solid iron. Mm-hmm. There is evidence for this via seismic waves, because some waves can travel through solids, and some can't travel through liquid, and they bounce and they go through like different phase changes. It's a huge field study. I'm not gonna get too far into it because it's a space podcast. Who cares? But the outer core is pretty much pure liquid, and there's a lot of convection going on in there, where all of it's spinning very rapidly up and down from the bottom up because it's superheated. As it goes up, it loses its heat, but it's mostly iron that causes our magnetic field.
Like a tornado kind of thing.
Not like a tornado, it's just a convection current. That causes our magnetic field. There's periods of time where it's not as strong, sometimes it reverses itself completely. No one really knows the mechanism behind that, besides that if it happened again, we'd all be toast.
That's what was supposed to happen in 2000, right?
In 2012.
Oh, no, the Mayans said that. I don't think I ever got bought on board with that. Like, they were like the magnetologists.
Calendar just restart according to them.
It's not really a way.
Have you felt alive since 2012 though?
Yeah, I've been dead inside.
It's not predictable how often the reversals occur.
Yeah.
Because we do know the mechanism by which it happens, just by the way we can figure out when they occur, how they occur, is by magnetic inclination of magnetic minerals. When they're suspended inside of a magma and they're cooling off, they can line themselves up with the direction of the magnetic field. And then when they solidify, they're stuck there. You can analyze the rocks and see, you know, where they were pointing whenever they were formed. And sometimes they point one way, sometimes with the other. And you can see, too, like, by, like, which angle, where the magnetic poles are at. And you can also tell...
Something with, like, the seafloor spreading?
That is part of the evidence for plate tectonics, mm-hmm. It is. But the main point of this is that sometimes you'll have periods where it'd be several tens of thousands of years where it's the same thing. Sometimes it'll flip every couple thousand years.
Why does it flip?
We don't really know why it flips.
And the next time
we just know the process is. We can know what the strength of the field is from these lines. And what happens is right before it flips, it kind of, like, the strength decreases a bunch to the point where it's like almost an intermediate strength. To get back to normal or to flip, it's just about the same amount of energy.
Do black holes have something like that, where the magnetic field flips by any means? Is there any evidence of that? Or can we even measure that at this point?
Like the fact that they're spinning?
A giant switch in the magnetic field, like, talking about the North Pole, South Pole.
Kind of. If we were, like, measuring it the entire time, I'm sure we could, but, like,
yeah.
The evidence for us on Earth is that we can look at old rocks that preserved it. If we didn't have that, like, our record for that only goes back 180 million years. The Earth's been around for 4.6 billion years. We don't know anything before that. Like, maybe it was all the same the entire way through. We just have no idea. Obviously, like, if we started observing a star for, like, the next, you know, 200,000 years, maybe we'd see it flip.
And once it flips on Earth, all our technology is going to green out, right? It's just going
to... No. The problem is that as the power decreases and it starts to flip, there's a period of, like, about, like, 100 to 1,000 years where there just really isn't a magnetic field at all. And then we're just, you know...
That would be shambles.
We're victims to solar radiation. Yeah. It would come back. Life would survive.
Yeah, I mean, we have an atmosphere, but, like, so that would sort of...
Would survive at this point, but, like,
I was just
waiting for
the idea that technology would just be destroyed.
Didn't that happen?
No, you're gonna try to induce
solar flare and it blew out all the what was it, like, the Morse code machines?
Yeah.
Didn't that just, like, fry?
That actually happened. Yeah. Yeah, it would, like, actually zap people who are trying to send Morse code messages.
That's wild.
Like, second degree burns or something.
Yeah. Let me see what the actual, it's like, it's called some event. I forget what it's called.
It's called the Varsity Show.
It was called the Carrington event. That was 1859.
The Hudson Valley.
This podcast was made possible by Audible. Audible is a leading provider of audiobooks. They have over 3 hours of audiobooks to choose from. Visit www.audible.com and use code word ELON at checkout for a free audiobook. Continuing on.
Any more questions about black holes? Or should
yes.
We...
So I heard Event Horizon, light can't escape from that. Singularity in the middle. It seems like anything between there, you can only like play with math. Is there any like what happens between like when you can't like the Earth? There's different layers, and like we know, it seems like we know the extremes, like the event horizon and singularity in the middle of the black hole. What's in between there? Like what happens?
It is impossible to know. However, we can speculate. So the math and the physics tells us something that doesn't really make sense. It says that all of the mass that's in the black hole goes to a singularity. So there's no real, like there's no layers inside of a black hole. There's nothing there. Like if you entered at the event horizon, if you were in a big enough black hole, you wouldn't even feel it. You would just know that everything is black and you're almost certainly dead. But like you wouldn't impact any surface. There is no surface. That's just the singularity.
We only know about the layers on Earth because of seismology.
Mm-hmm.
Like essentially, I'll go a little deeper in the process now. When we have an earthquake, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can imagine a certain point on the surface of the sphere where the earthquake occurs. Your waves are
like on the crust.
Yeah, on the crust. Well, we can imagine that your waves of energy, you know, come out of that and you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of a spherical shape. What we notice is that you can measure these waves on that kind of seismology anywhere on the planet. Except for like directly antipode in like a certain area, it's like a shadow zone where you can't read certain waves.
Where it just like cancels out.
There's S waves and P waves. S waves are shearing waves and P waves are kind of pulsating waves. One's like a compression and one's a shear.
Mm-hmm.
The compression can travel through liquid. We know this because you can see it across lakes on a really surface level earthquake
mm-hmm.
nearby. And the shear and the you know the pulsating wave or the shearing waves just don't because they go like this. They don't go through
podcast
liquid.
Podcast people can't.
The point is, it's quickly discovered that some of the waves can be measured directly across the entire Earth, and some of them can't. And as they started putting them together, they realized that there's a certain area in the inside where it's liquid. And then whenever you cross from like one area to another, it bends. Your wave like completely bends.
The way you can tell it bends
is from it's not how it works at all. It's just because varying densities between like the crust and then the mantle and the core. The varying densities will change your speed of your wave, such to the point where what you expect your time to be at your other seismogram is completely different. So over like tons of years, they collected all the data on different you know seismograms all around the world. Each time there was an earthquake, and then they map around what had to be going on the inside to get our layers. We can't really do that in a star or a black hole. First of all, I don't even know if there's earthquakes on them. Well, I guess it'd be called a starquake at that point, huh?
I think it's a thing.
No, that's a great name for a heavy metal band. Copyright, acclaim it, boom, diss.
Starquake? I kind of like
yeah.
that, actually.
Yeah!
Starquake?
Dude!
Can that be our band name?
A starquake
Russian.
Is a real thing.
I'm literally a legend.
It happens
well,
on neutron stars. Apparently.
Also, Starquake is now our band name.
Have we gotten enough
yes.
on the formation, you know, the layers of the Earth and also black holes?
Black hole question. So, black holes, they constantly accrue mass. How long until we're all lingunified?
Don't they evaporate, like, at some point?
They do.
Evaporate?
Yeah.
How
well,
do they end? Like, what happens?
Where do they go?
When there's just nothing left? I mean, we can't observe that, but, I mean, it takes, like, I think it's 10 to, like, the 87 years.
They
have
a shelf life, right?
Yeah, like 10 to the
what
87
happens at
years.
The end? Do they just like disappear?
It gets all chunky to throw it out.
But,
oh, that's milk.
I mean, 10 to the 87 years, at that point, like the heat death of the universe will have long happened. So.
Oh, so there's no black holes that have already formed?
No.
And
well, there are ones that like ones that we created in the Large Hadron Collider that are exist for like a nanosecond. But like an actual like naturally occurring black hole, no, there's no naturally occurring black hole that's been created that has since decayed.
So it doesn't even matter.
Nothing matters.
This is a uniquely depressing podcast. It just puts everything in such cosmic perspective that you feel so insignificant.
Good thing you're an urban planner.
Amen.
Speaking of everyone dying, this podcast was made possible by Policy Genius. Face it, you're going to die one day. Don't leave your family or loved ones bereft. You can go to PolicyGenius.com and compare insurance rates such as life, disability, and renter's insurance. Use code word ELON at signup to get a share of Henry's life insurance policy as soon as he accidentally meets his end.
So, yesterday there was the second ever launch of the Falcon Heavy, which is the largest operational rocket in the world. And it was successful. All three of the boosters landed, which means that they saved a lot of money. SpaceX, their rocket is called the Falcon Heavy, their big one. So they launched it successfully yesterday. Nothing really, you know, particularly groundbreaking to report. I mean, the first one, that was in February of last year.
Yeah.
And that was a huge deal. There was a lot of media coverage. This time it's sort of like they launched it again.
Oh, they did it again.
This time. Yeah, so the thing that was sort of disappointing last time is that the center core booster, it didn't land properly. Well, it had a rapid unscheduled disassembly. it basically yeah, it hit the it hit the barge it was supposed to land on at like 500 miles per hour. So that less than ideal. Yeah, but the two other boosters you probably saw like on the news, like they landed perfectly fine. This time all of them landed fine, which means that they saved like $80 million or something ridiculous. So yeah, they're doing really well. This time it was just like there was no roadster on it. It was just a normal satellite, a communication satellite.
What's next for them?
What's next? To go to Venus, right?
Venus?
Yeah.
Mars?
Oh, Mars, yeah.
Same
you
thing.
You're on a space podcast. You can't... Yeah.
It's like if you take the wrong turn in space...
guys, it's all right. Mike doesn't even know his times tables.
Well, the interesting thing... So, in terms of the future of SpaceX, there's this big NASA project, called SLS, the Space Launch System. Basically, NASA paid, and I guess... You know, the American taxpayer, therefore, has paid something like $15 billion to NASA, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin to build this massive rocket that would go to the moon. The problem is it's been like 10 years and they haven't even built a prototype. They just, yeah, it's just bureaucracy and they just take out a bunch of money. And it's like, it's under development. Recently, NASA has decided to not scrap the project, but instead of launching with that rocket to go to the moon, to do asteroid redirect missions, they're paying SpaceX to do it. So NASA doesn't have their own rocket, so they're just paying SpaceX. So that looks like that's the future of SpaceX.
Just NASA outsources all their crap to it.
Mm-hmm. Also, they're building the largest rocket ever right now. They've tested it a few times. Like last week, they were testing it in Texas. It's taller than the Statue of Liberty.
This is Rocket Science, is the Columbia Space Initiative podcast, produced by Henry Minelski and David Tibbetts. Executive producers, Natasha Dada and Luke DeCruz. PR director, Anthony Odessa. Consultant, Logan Tedder. Audio is mixed by Micah Weiss. Edited by Kate Steiner. That's all, folks.